Great to have you along with us on the Ideas Network. John Munson here in for Larry Mueller. Today on Garden Talk, we're talking about high tunnels with Jason Fishbach, an agriculture agent for the University of Wisconsin Extension in Ashland and Bayfield counties. So how do you extend the growing season in your garden? Do you use high tunnels or cold frames? Do you have spring gardening questions? You can join us by calling 800-642-1234 or by posting your questions and photos on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Jason, welcome to Garden Talk, or I should say welcome back.
Yeah, hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you today. Let's start out by asking this essential question. What's the difference between a high tunnel, a greenhouse, and a cold frame?
Sure. So a greenhouse typically is made out of a hard plastic or glass, and it's heated, right? A high tunnel typically is just a single or double layer of plastic on a metal frame, and there's usually no heat added. And then a cold frame is usually just a much shorter, smaller structure that's intended just to protect plants or harden them off for a couple of weeks during the year.
So how can these structures benefit our backyard gardeners?
Well, I'll tell you, folks that start to use high tunnels typically don't have gardens outside anymore. They just grow it inside their high tunnel because the productivity is so much greater and the quality is much higher and your season is much longer. It really changes the way you garden.
Well, the growing season, of course, is a big issue for us at this latitude.
For sure, you know, especially as far north as I am up in Ashland and Bayfield County, there are years where you can't ripen a tomato or ripen peppers, and then you throw disease pressures from all the rain on top of it, and can be a nightmare. So you do this in a high tunnel, and you've got tomatoes in July all the way into sometimes November.
Wow.
Without any added heat.
I love tomatoes. So what do we need to know before we try to build one of these high tunnels?
Well, luckily, the world of high tunnels is exploding, and there's many sources of resources to learn about high tunnels. That's the place to start, is to figure out, what to buy, how big to buy, and how it best fits what your intended use is. If you're a home gardener and you're limited on space, you can certainly use high tunnels, but typically the smaller high tunnels need to be more intensively managed because they heat up so fast because they're small. We recommend a kind of a minimum size of maybe a 20 foot wide by 48 feet long. That's more than enough produce for a family of 4 to 6, and you're going to be using that starting, these days you can use these things year-round, with a lot of our pioneering growers looking at some overwintering of spring green-type crops and spinach and chard and that kind of thing.
Well, I guess one concern I would have would be, how do you make sure that in a really good wind, and we certainly get those in Wisconsin, especially along Lake Superior, how do we make sure that our high tunnel doesn't collapse or end up out in the woods someplace?
Yeah, great question. So the manufacturers definitely are aware of these issues and have come up with some really nice designs and engineering for these to hold up to not only strong winds, but also snow loads, especially when we get these heavy, wet spring snows. So a couple of things. These are not usually cemented in the ground. They are, the ground posts that hold them down are just driven down into the ground a couple of feet. And then the hoops or the bows that go across are bolted onto those ground posts. Now, the key with managing the wind is being attentive to if there's a storm coming, for example. If you close up the high tunnels, meaning you close the end wall doors and you roll down the sidewalls, then the wind can't get up in underneath there. And the way they're built is the wind kind of comes in and over the high tunnel, so it kind of blows it down, and you usually won't pick it up. Snow load can be an issue, and so that's where we talk about bow spacing, how wide apart your supports are, and having some truss work in there as well to help hold things tight. And a big part of the wind is the one or two layers of plastic. If you have two layers of plastic and you blow some air in there with a little fan, you create this cushion of air that it's pretty amazing. When the wind blows, it pushes on that cushion of air and it leaves the structure alone. So the growers are definitely aware of, these issues and have come up with some great techniques and systems to manage it. But every now and again, you will hear about a high tunnel that picks up and goes for a ride.
Well, the same thing could happen to your garage. So,
that's,
you know,
exactly.
Mother Nature is in charge, and every now and then she has to remind us. So what materials would you recommend we use if we're going to build one of these?
So you've got some folks that will kind of cobble things together using PVC pipe. And my kind of rule of thumb is build it nice or build it twice. So you're better off buying some galvanized steel pipe, and you can bend it yourself if you've got the skills and a couple of handy tools, or you can just buy kits, and the price is, you know, to the point where it's pretty affordable for most folks. So it's galvanized steel piping, and then the plastic is attached with something called wiggle wire, which is, it's so simple, it's laughable, but that's really all it takes. And then you've got a couple of ground boards that run along the side that help hold things together, and that's why they're so fun and so easy, is they're so simple, but they work so well.
Okay, so well, we've talked about some of the advantages of using a high tunnel, particularly in our climate at our latitude and up where you are. You really do have some advantages in terms of the length of the growing season. But what are the conditions where a high tunnel wouldn't be a good idea?
If what can happen is if you're not able to manage it well, right, and you happen to leave the thing closed on a sunny, warm day in the summer, it might get 120 degrees in there and everything's dead.
Oof.
So if you're the kind of gardener that you want to go away for 4 or 5 days at a time, you know, it may not be the right fit for you. But otherwise, it's you know, I think it can work everywhere. The smaller greenhouses, people will try them sometimes, and they can work as more of a cold frame, but they just heat up so fast, and your growing space is fairly limited. So mm-hmm. those would be the only conditions I would think of. You know, high snow, high wind areas, you can make them work.
Okay, great. 800-642-1234. It's Garden Talk this week, and John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Jason Fishbach is my guest, and we're taking your gardening questions. Of course, we're almost to spring on the calendar. Meteorologists say we're already in spring. You know, let's just split the difference and say it's on the way. Up your way, though, Jason, you just got a fresh blanket of snow, but I guess this time of year it won't stick around too long, so people really are starting to think about getting into gardening, and we want to hear those questions at 800-642-1234. Now, Jason, one of your areas of expertise is fruit trees. Planting an orchard or even a few trees can seem pretty complicated. Where do we start?
It starts with understanding your site and understanding how cold you get in the winter, understanding if you've got clay or sand and how well things drain, and understanding your pH of the soil. That's going to drive a lot of what types of crops you can grow, or fruit crops, and then what varieties you'll grow once you decide. So you really have to understand your site first.
All right. We actually have some people who have fruit tree questions. Stacy on Facebook writes that she would like suggestions for low-maintenance fruit trees and would also like to know, is a dwarf cherry variety the best choice?
Right. So on the low-maintenance fruit trees, probably your best bet are the high disease resistant type cultivars of apple. Apple tends to handle just about any of our whatever winter can throw our way, and something like a Liberty apple, the plant is resistant both to apple scab, powdery mildew, and fire blight. So that's really as low maintenance as it gets. Now you do have to do some pruning on apples to help control where that fruit is set and how early you get it. So. And with respect to dwarf cherries, you know, it's interesting. The dwarf cherries like Lappin or Cavalier put on the Gisela rootstock, which is what makes them dwarf, may not be as winter hardy. We've been doing some trials up here in Bayfield, and sweet cherries are already on the cusp of being suitable because they're just not that hardy. But if you put them on standard rootstock like Mazard rootstock, they tend to be a little bit more cold hardy. At least that's been our experience so far in our trials up in Bayfield.
Well, Bayfield, I can attest, has been producing some pretty good sweet cherries over the last few years.
Yeah, it's been great. It's when they're on, they're on. But it's not every year. You know, we get really harsh winters. And actually, the bigger threat these days are these early springs. You know, nothing's worse for fruit crops than an early warm March. So this cool down and the cover of snow is a blessing for fruit growers up here.
Okay. Well, you know, it's an ill wind that blows no one any good. 800-642-1234. Bill in Milwaukee has a fruit tree question. Let's go there first. Bill, go ahead.
Hi, Jason. Can you tell me, do you have a YouTube video on the of what you're trying to produce?
Are you talking about the high tunnel?
Yeah.
Yeah, Jason, do you know, is there a YouTube video on high tunnels?
I'm sure there are. So if you just start Googling around or go to YouTube and search for videos on high tunnel production, you'll find all kinds of stuff from individual growers to companies that sell the high tunnel packages. The Penn State University and the University of Minnesota also operate pretty extensive high tunnel research programs, and they've got some good videos and resources for you.
And, Bill, you also had a question about an apple tree.
Right. I had an apple, Honeycrisp, 6 years ago, no production. And because my neighbor had several trees, I planted a starter Honeycrisp. And then last year I had three apples. Is it because it had been there for 6 years, or was it because of the apple tree that I planted finally?
So your Honeycrisp, if I understand this right, started out with some apples, but it...
No, I never had apples on it because my neighbor had apple trees in his yard. So I just started with the one. And then 6 years went by, nothing. And then last year I planted a starter Honeycrisp tree, and then I had three or four apples on my tree for the first time. Was it because of the fact that I had finally planted that tree, or the other one had enough time to get production?
Good question. So we forget, you know, apple trees need a pollinizer, and they need a different variety. So in your case, that might very well have happened, is once those other trees got planted, then you had a pollen source. But typically, because there are so many apples around and bees move pretty far, you don't worry about it. Now, in the case of your specific tree, it could also be that it finally just got old enough. You know, with apple trees, if they're left on their own, they tend to grow straight up and they'll stay vegetative longer, especially if they're on a standard full-size rootstock. So that's where we use pruning and training to try to get those branches more horizontal, and then they'll produce fruit earlier. So it could have been either one, but, you know, it certainly helps to have multiple varieties of apples around to make sure that you've got that good cross-pollination.
Bill, thanks. Thanks for that question. Let's go to we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll have more of Garden Talk. Jason Fishbach, my guest. We're taking your gardening questions today on Garden Talk and the Larry Mueller Show. John Munson in for Larry. We'll have more with Jason and with your calls and Facebook comments in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you could join us today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Larry Mueller this week. And my guest is Jason Fishbach, and he's a regular here on Garden Talk. Jason is a UW Extension agriculture agent serving Ashland and Bayfield counties. So, Jason, we were talking about getting started with planting fruit trees. A lot of people thinking about maybe starting a small orchard, even a few trees. Sometimes it can seem pretty complicated. You gave us a couple of really great tips a little bit ago. I'd like to ask you a couple more questions about that before we go back to the phones. First of all, where would you recommend we go to find out some information we might need before we start planting trees? What's the best place to find out what to do?
Well, for sure, talk to your local extension agent. They're going to help out with some variety recommendations. But really, talking to your neighbors is a good place to start, too, to see what trees they have or fruit crops they have and how they're doing. Because typically, your neighbors will have a similar soil and similar environment. So if you can find out and, you know, find the neighbors that have the really nice fruit crops, that's a great place to start.
Okay.
Our horticulture website with UW Extension has a lot of great bulletins and publications about fruit crops.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Okay, and where should we buy our trees?
Well, this is a trickier part, especially when you with fruit trees, because you would like to get the right variety and rootstock combination for both the way you want to grow trees and the way you or the kind of production or spraying, for example, that you're going to tolerate. So, for example, you can, based on the rootstock, you get different sizes of trees, semi-dwarf, full dwarf for a standard tree. So if you've got deer pressure and you don't want to put a fence around them all the time or its whole life, then you're going to need a standard-sized tree. So if you're buying from local nurseries, which is usually the easiest way to get your plants, then, you know, ask them what the rootstocks are and do some research about the right rootstock for your situation. And if they only have, you know, one option, which is sometimes the case, then you may have to go online and look at ordering from a nursery. And there's, you know, a number out of Michigan or out of Washington State. And the only challenge there is you usually have to order a minimum, and it might be as many as 25 trees at a time. So you'll have to, if you don't want that many, you'll have to rope in some friends and family and do a bulk order. But it's really important, especially with these tree fruits, to get that right rootstock and variety combination.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of soil is best? For example, if I was thinking about putting some fruit trees in my backyard, where I live, it's very, very heavy clay. Will fruit trees do well in that environment, or what kind of soil do they need?
Well, the well-drained, the magic well-drained sandy loam that we all talk about, that, of course, is the best. Apple trees can tolerate a little wider range of soil conditions, and for those on clay, you can even choose from rootstock that are better adapted. So M111 rootstock, for example, is known to tolerate heavy clay soils fairly well. Some species and varieties just are not going to handle some soil conditions. So blueberries mm-hmm. would be classic, right? They're just not going to do very well on clay with a high pH. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a more well-drained and a lower pH soil. So it really starts with, okay, here's my soil type, and then doing some research to figure out what fruit crops are an absolute no for that soil type, which ones work without too much effort. And then you can amend those soils and the site a little bit to make some of the borderline varieties or types of fruit work. Because clay isn't the end of the world for fruit trees, but sometimes you have to do some amending, bring organic matter up, or make sure your drainage.
It's work even to get flowers. So for the beginner, what kind of trees would you suggest? If someone's just getting started with fruit trees, what's the way to go there?
First thing is to make sure the deer can't get to your fruit crops. No one wants to hear that or do that, but really that's what I tell folks is before you plant a tree, plant a fence. And fence out the yard or fence out the area you're going to grow the fruit trees because you're going to pull your hair out because the deer every year will find those fruit trees and chew on them, and then the form gets screwed up and the production gets cut way down. So mm-hmm. that's the place to start. And then you kind of have to decide, do you want to grow for just a couple of fruit crops just for yourself or fruit trees, or do you want to try to kind of up your production level? And sort of like this high tunnel question with gardening, you can garden outside or you can really up the ante and grow even better in a high tunnel. So you can do things like high density apple production. Rather than just one big tree that's hard to manage, you could do five or six smaller trees that are much easier to manage in the same mm-hmm. space, as long as you've got the deer under control. Yeah.
And how long after we plant these trees should we reasonably expect to get some fruit?
It all depends on what you buy. So you can buy, if you're doing fruit trees, you can buy a whip, and that's just a single straight stem, and it might be 3 or 4 years before you get any fruit. Or you can buy what's called a feathered tree, where you've got a bunch of side branches, and they've actually been trained well in the nursery, so you've got some horizontal branching, and you could very well have apples that first year that you plant. You typically don't want it that first year. You'd want to prune off the blossoms or pinch them off so the tree can get well established, and then the next year you can get a crop. So it just depends on how much you want to spend on your nursery stock.
Sure. And other than deer, what are the biggest threats to growing fruit?
Well, disease pressure. For apples, it's apple scab, and thankfully we have some resistant varieties that make apple growing a lot easier. If you do the susceptible varieties, you're going to have to spray something. Or you're going to have scab. Some years you get by with little scab, but most years you've got scab pressure. If you're trying to grow things like plums or cherries, you've got American brown rot to worry about. And so anything you can do to buy varieties that are disease resistant just makes your life that much easier. Because eventually, the first couple of years, you probably get by disease free, but eventually it catches up to you. And then once it's in your planting, your garden, or your orchard, it's there forever.
Well, we've got a lot more questions to get to. Let's start with a caller who couldn't stay with us. Roman is in Wausau, and he called to ask if treated lumber around a garden plot will harm vegetables.
Yeah, it's a great question, and a lot of it kind of has to do with each individual's risk tolerance. And so there's been some work done, and there's a study out of University of Minnesota where they had some treated lumber around gardens, and they were there for 20 years. And they excavated the soil right next to the lumber, and they brought that soil into a greenhouse and put it in pots and then grew vegetables in that soil and then tried to measure cadmium, arsenic, lead, whatever they thought might be in that wood. And it was not in the plants, and typically for most vegetables, they don't take up heavy metals that are fixed to the soil. But they did find elevated levels of some chemicals coming from the wood in the soil itself. So if you don't want to risk anything, then don't use it or plant. You know, the soil, when they did that analysis, it was only about a couple of inches away from the wood. It didn't get all the way through into the garden. So that's generally what I tell folks is if you're concerned at all about it, then just don't use it. You can find things like cedar or even black locust or white oak, other rot-resistant woods that'll last a good decade if it's a fairly dry site, and then you don't have to worry about it.
All right, let's take some more phone calls. We'll start in Kenosha where Tim has a question. Tim, welcome to Garden Talk.
Oh, thank you very much. And I appreciate the extension service, too, and all you guys do. I had a question about hoop houses and pollination. I know tomatoes and eggplant, that family of plants, need specific pollination, primarily using bumblebees. And I'm wondering if you have much information on that. Concern about imported bumblebees and spread of diseases into the natural environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So with the way most tie tunnels are operated is you roll up the sides during the day. And, you know, we've got a couple of them at our house, and we'll be out there first thing in the morning, roll them up, and they'll stay open all day until night, then we'll roll them back down. And so bumblebees and everything else is free to move in and out. And actually, so are the aphids and cabbage loopers and everything else. So in that way, you tend to get your pollination is fine. You don't need to necessarily bring in pollinators. Now, there's been some work recently to try to grow fruit crops in high tunnels, and you'll usually get a bloom earlier than maybe even the bumblebees are awake. And so then you've got to bring in bumblebees. And, yeah, there could be concern about moving in foreign genetics and that kind of thing. But typically for if you're growing vegetables in a high tunnel, because you've got those doors open for ventilation, you get plenty of insect activity.
All right, Tim, thanks for that question and your call. Let's go next to Denise in Dodgeville. Denise, hello. Welcome to Garden Talk.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm fairly new to Wisconsin, and I did winter sowing this year. So outside, I have four milk jugs filled with lettuce, kale, spinach, and peas. Everything's up. When can I put them in the ground?
Well, it's going to depend on the forecast, really. So those are all species that can of crop that can handle some pretty cold nights. I think once your ground is warmed up and dried out, and so let's say the soil temperature is a good 50 degrees or so, and you can just use a meat thermometer to take the soil temperature, then look at your forecast. You know, some years it's middle of March you could plant that stuff, depending on where you are. Some years it might be into April before you would plant. And if we see a cold snap coming, you might hold off until that passes. You do have the option to put low tunnels, and that's nothing more than, say, a piece of PVC bent over to make a little hoop, and then you just drape some plastic over the top. So that can buy you a few degrees at night to help keep those protected if you do get a surprise cold snap. Or you can use a product called floating row cover. It's just a polyspun fabric, kind of like a bed sheet, really, a little lighter weight than that, and you just drape that over the plants, and it lets air and it lets water through, but it keeps the bugs out, and it retains heat at night, and you'd actually just leave that on the garden all spring, and that can be a real effective way. And when I was in Sweden growing potatoes, the whole game was to get new potatoes by Midsummer Night Eve, their big holiday there, and they would cover their potato fields, you know, acres at a time with this floating row cover, leave it there all spring in order to get those plants to grow a lot faster so they would get the potatoes for the holiday.
Hmm. Interesting. Denise, thanks for the call. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join us on Garden Talk today. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Jason Fischbach is my guest. He's a UW Extension Agriculture Agent for Bayfield and Ashland Counties. Let's go next to Marty in Kenilworth. Marty, you're on Garden Talk. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks, Jason, for your time. I have a 125-year-old bur oak tree that last year, toward the end of the year, seemed to be inundated with these long black caterpillars with long, tall black hairs. So I went to the store, bought some solution to put in a ring around the base of the tree, and my buddy who owns a nursery said, hey, you want to, don't want to do that now. It's transferring all its energies down to the root system. You want to wait till the spring. That sounds logical to me. At what time do I do this in the spring? When the ground doesn't get below freezing, when the tree's budding, et cetera, et cetera? And I'll listen to your answer off air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Jason, what should he do about his oak tree?
Sure. So if I understood the question right, he's thinking of applying a root drench insecticide that would be taken up by the tree and then stop the caterpillar feeding. You know, a tree that large and that old is going to be able to tolerate a fair amount of feeding by insects. And so really the first step is try to identify exactly what that pest is, and then determine how much of an impact it might have on the tree, and then make a decision whether or not to be pouring insecticide around the base of the tree. Typically, if you're trying to move product up into a tree, and you know we do this, for example, for emerald ash borer, is you'd want to do it in the spring when it's moving material up into the tree rather than down into the roots. So they're correct on that point. If it's, you know, we have gypsy moth issues too, and we'll sometimes put fabric or guards around the trunk of the tree to keep them from climbing up into the tree. That's another strategy that can happen. But really, you got to know what that pest is first before you kind of develop a control strategy or determine whether it's even worth it.
So maybe you should take a picture of it and send it to PJ Leash or somebody, one of the entomologists with Extension or with the university, to get an idea of what he's dealing with.
Exactly right. You can just capture a couple of them and bring them into his local Extension office, and
okay,
they can help from there.
Okay. All right. Let's, 800-642-1234. That's how you join us on Garden Talk. You can also post your gardening questions on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's take a call from Green Bay next. Dan, you'll be next, and you're with us on Garden Talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I've got ornamental flowery crabs that produce fruit. Will a crab apple cross-pollinate a regular apple?
Yeah, yep. So we use crab apples in apple orchards all the time just for that reason as a pollinizer.
All right. Dan, thanks a lot, and good luck with your apples. Let's see. From Dan in Green Bay, we'll go to Janet, who calls us from Oak Creek. Janet, hello. You're on Garden Talk.
Oh, good morning. I have two pawpaw trees that are about 8 years old, and I finally got flowers on both of the trees. I had one fruit last year, and it did self-abort. So I'm just hoping to get any tips that you might have on pawpaws, growing them in our area. I have clay soil. I also have the same problem with my Mount Royal plum. It's about 8 years. I get little baby fruit, and they all just drop off. I don't think I've had one plum yet. So any kind of help you can give on pawpaws and just this issue with the fruit aborting?
Sure. So unfortunately on the pawpaws, because I'm so far north in Wisconsin, I never work with pawpaws because they're just not hardy for us. So I have to check with an agent closer to you to help on that one. With respect to the cherries, so Mount Royal is, you know, supposed to be a self-pollinizer, and you don't need one. The experience has been if you can get a pollinizer to go with it, you're going to get a better fruit set. And Toca is a great one to help with that, another variety. Now, sometimes what's happening with plums is an insect called Plum curculio and this happens to our plums all the time, is the insect comes in just as the fruit are starting to expand, and they'll do some feeding and egg laying on those tiny little fruit, and that causes them to drop. And you'll probably never see, unless you're really out there looking, you'll never see the plum curculio, but you'll see little crescent-shaped feeding marks or egg-laying marks on the tiny little fruit, and you'll see it happen. It goes fast. So the first real warm night of the year, once those fruit are out, the plum curculio will climb up into the tree and do all their damage. So it's a real pain. There's really no good or no spray technique. You're using either some sort of an anti-feedant spray like a kaolin clay, or you're looking at an insecticide to try to control them. So it could be the pollinizer issue, and certainly having another pollinizer is going to help regardless. But also look to see if you've got some plum curculio feeding, and then you're going to have to figure out how to control them.
And for the pawpaw question, Janet should check with her local extension office.
Yep.
Okay. Janet, thanks for joining us on Garden Talk today. Let's go to La Crosse next, and we will hear from Pete. Pete, welcome to Garden Talk.
Good morning, John, and to your guests. I have several fruit trees, and I'm thinking, I have room for two more fruit trees, so I kind of want to fill out the inventory, so to speak. So what I have is two pear trees, three cherry trees, two apricot trees, and they all seem to be doing pretty well. And I have two apple trees, one suffering from cedar rust complex. So I don't know if I should go with a different species or some different variations on apple to fill in those two spots. What are my options there?
Well, it sounds like, yeah, because you can solve that cedar rust issue. If you go, and I don't have it in front of me right now, but if you go online and look for, I believe it's Penn State's website, you can look for the disease resistance chart for all the different apple varieties. And there will be some that are resistant to cedar apple rust. Liberty, I know, is resistant because it's resistant to just about everything. So that would be an easy way to kind of solve that problem. And it sounds like you could use some apples in that fruit mix.
All right, Pete, thanks for that call and for joining us today on Garden Talk. 800-642-1234. If you get a busy signal, you can also post on the Garden, post your question for Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go next to Sugar Camp and talk with Kel. As soon as I can get the button pushed here. There we go. Kel, welcome to Garden Talk.
Well, thank you very much. I might have a quick question. I was told that these dwarf sour cherry trees, like North Star, or I forget what the other one is, don't live very long. They live like 5 or 6 years, and then you just replace them, and that's what growers were doing out in Door County because they were easier to deal with because they were shorter. I was wondering if that's true and if it's worth the investment. Will they live a lot longer than that?
They will. They're not a very long-lived tree, primarily because they get a disease called bacterial canker. The wood is prone to cracking, and it creates these entry points for the bacteria, and you end up with this gumming. It's the sappy stuff that starts coming out, and it'll end up girdling branches, and eventually it girdles the whole trunk. It's a real challenging disease, and that's what shortens the life of those dwarf cherry trees. But usually it's longer than 5 or 6 years. It just depends a little bit on the weather of the last few winters. You know, we've had some really challenging winters recently for fruit crops, and especially the early springs. And so we've had a lot more damage. We've even seen damage recently from the winter of 2012 and 2013. We're still seeing problems with apple trees, because it created entry wounds with the freezing and thawing of the bark, and we've got a lot of black rot still killing trees. So it's it's complicated, especially with these tree fruits.
All right, Kel, good luck with your dwarf cherry trees. 800-642-1234. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Larry will be back next week. Jason Fishbach is my guest on Garden Talk this week. He's a UW Extension Agriculture Agent for Bayfield and Ashland Counties. We're taking your gardening questions this hour. And you can call us at 800-642-1234 or post a picture or a question on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. That's just as good. Let's go back to the phones. Dan is with us in Fond du Lac.
Hello.
And Dan, hello. Welcome to Garden Talk.
Hi. I believe I've got a problem with my tomato plants on wilt. It's been going on for probably 4 or 5 years. The leaves starting at the base, maybe halfway through the season, they start to dry, get spots and dry up, and I'll usually pick them off. But someone told me that mulching with either pine or spruce needles is a way to prevent that. Is there anything to that?
Yes. So that is most likely a fungal disease called septorial leaf spot. Very, very common. Almost all tomatoes that are grown outside are going to at some point deal with this problem. And it's such a nasty one because once it's in your garden, it's kind of there forever. So the fungus actually will overwinter on tomato leaf tissue that's in the soil. And then in the spring or in the summer when the tomatoes are back in there, when it rains, it'll splash back up the fungal spores and reinfect. So that's why having that mulch layer can be helpful. And some growers will tell you that it works great, and others will tell you, you know, they've tried everything and they can't get rid of septorial leaf spot. Ultimately, if you can stop that splashing back, you can stop the disease, and that's where high tunnels have become so popular with tomato growers, is that that can basically stop septorial leaf spot because it no longer rains on the tomatoes. It's irrigating from below, and so that keeps the leaves dry, and you don't have the splashing, and you don't get the leaf spot.
Hmm. Okay.
So, you know, if you're outside, for sure, try the mulching. And if you're, you know, if you use, you should start by making sure you get as much of that tomato plant residue out of the garden and picking those leaves off early before they dry up and turn to dust and go back into the soil. You know, that's what's re-inoculating the next year. So trying to practice sanitation and then put on a good heavy mulch layer after you plant should help.
Another recommendation, though, for using the high tunnel system for gardening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dan, thanks thanks for your question on Garden Talk today. Let's take another question. This time we'll get another fruit tree question from Barb in Invergrove, Minnesota. Barb, welcome to Garden Talk.
Thank you. We've been having an apple problem called russeting, and we have a Harrelson apple. Is there any cure for that?
Sometimes it's management related. Are you doing any spraying or anything else in the?
Well, what do you mean, spraying the yard,
or spraying the actual apple trees?
Yeah, my husband does spray it occasionally.
Okay. For apple scab or for insects or?
Yeah, I'm not sure what product he uses.
So sometimes. Spraying at the wrong time or the wrong product or at the wrong rate can cause some russeting on the apple skin. So it'd be good just to kind of double check the control program and make sure the right rate's being used, the right product for what's being controlled. And your folks there in Minnesota should be able to help you kind of design a pest management program for your trees. That'd be a good place to start. Harrelson also sometimes is a little bit more prone to russeting, so you could try some other varieties. And, you know, if you want, you can also graft other varieties onto the same tree. A lot of growers and gardeners will do that. You just have to find some scion wood from other growers or other trees and then just graft onto some of the branches. And there's some good tutorials online. That's where YouTube is so great because it will show you a lot of hands-on how to do the actual grafting. A lot of different techniques out there, and you just kind of play with it that way to try to mix up the varieties.
Mm. Barb, thanks for your question. And Jason, we've mentioned YouTube videos and things like that and sending people emails. Boy, the internet really has to have been a big benefit to you in your work as an agriculture educator.
Well, it definitely goes both ways, though, because it helps a lot to get the information out there in an efficient way. But there's also a lot of bad information out there.
Ah.
So it's important to kind of filter through it. And my rule of thumb, of course I'm biased, work with Extension, but whenever you do any searching on garden-related or farming-related topics, just include the word Extension in your search term, and that'll pull up all the research-based information that's coming out of university programs. You can get a lot from the chat groups and from individuals posting information, but you've got to take some of it with a grain of salt because it's usually not replicated research-based type information.
Well, in these days, any Google search, the first five or six items in the search are going to be ads. So
that's right. So if they're trying to sell you something, right, you got to keep that in mind too.
Caveat emptor, I think, would be our watchword here. Let's take another call at 800-642-1234 and a tree question from Ben, who's calling us from Verona today. Ben, welcome to Garden Talk.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I've got a Canadian red maple. That's all I know the name of it. I got it at Walmart, about 15 years ago. Beautiful tree in the fall when it turns red. It gets like a fire red. It's got a lot of branches at the base now, and it's a real full, plump tree. And it's kind of starting to overwhelm some plants and shrubs below it. What's a good time to I'd like to trim up some of those branches, kind of cut them up from the base up a little bit. What would be a good time to trim those? I don't know if it's, where I wouldn't have to worry about disease or infection or anything.
Today and not a day later. I mean, really, this time of year is the best time to get out there before you start getting bud swell and bud break. And, depending where you are and how your microclimate's coming along, you want to get out there and prune. So especially when you've got are you getting more branches off the trunk that you're taking off, or do you have suckers coming right at the base of the tree?
A little of both. The base of the tree, geez, I bet it's probably maybe 3 feet, 2 or 3 feet off the ground. Then I've got some pretty decent-sized branches coming off of it, and then some smaller ones are sprouting out. It's a really full, round, plump tree. That doesn't have a very big trunk for as old as it is, too.
Sure.
I bet maybe the trunk's 8, 9 inches maybe in diameter. But,
So red maples, when you do make some cuts, you're going to get a lot of suckering and sprouting. So go ahead and make the cut as soon as you can, and don't paint the wounds or anything. Just they're going to weep a little bit with sap, and that's okay. Eventually, the cut ends will dry up and seal off. And then what you'll see is around the edge of the cut, you'll start getting more buds starting to break as we get into the growing season here. You can actually just rub those off with your thumb. Instead of waiting for them to grow out, and then, by the end of the year, they could be an inch in diameter, those suckers, and then you're right back to square one next year. So cut them, let them kind of do their thing, and once you start seeing some green growth around the pruning stubs, then just rub them off with your thumb, and that'll help kind of seal up and stop the growth there.
All right, Ben, thanks for that call. Would that be a general rule of thumb for pruning trees? Now is the time to do it?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, it's, if you're in the southern part of the state, especially with this early warm-up, it's getting to be almost too late to some degree. It's better now than in a month, for sure. But
well, before you see budding.
That's right. You'd like to do this in February, or we used to say early March, but these days,
we're starting to get Missouri's climate.
That's right.
Thanks, Ben, for that call. We're going to take a break and come back. We'll have more with Jason Fischbach and your questions on Garden Talk. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. We're we're taking your gardening questions. Jason Fischbach is here. He's an agriculture agent for UW Extension in Ashland and Bayfield counties. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to join us on Garden Talk. Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll go to Edgerton, where Betsy is joining us. Betsy, thanks for joining us on Garden Talk today.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about a small crab apple that's planted on the terrace in front of my home, but it was already planted by the city before I purchased the home. It's probably about 2 years old. I don't know what type it is, and I don't know how to care for it. Any ideas?
Yeah, the crab apple, so if it was planted recently, it's likely an improved cultivar of some kind. And the University of Minnesota, their landscape arboretum has been involved in ornamental crab production and development over the years. So if you go to their website, you can flip through the various cultivars, and it has great pictures. And so hopefully through the flower color and that kind of thing, you could figure out what exactly it might be. Or if you can find out who planted it. If the city did it, they'll probably have their species list. You can find out that way. Crab apples are nice because they're pretty low maintenance. Generally, their growth form is fairly compact and regular, so you'd don't do a lot of pruning. In fact, you usually don't want to do any pruning unless there's a, you know, a storm damage or something, because they will sprout so vigorously from those pruning wounds. Now, the crab apples can and get apple scab just like our eating apples do, and you might see the tree be defoliated almost entirely earlier in the fall than other trees. And really, there's, you know, you don't want to probably spray the trees. You could to control the scab, but if you rake up those leaves at the end of the year and compost them or get them out of there, then you don't have that inoculum as much to reinfect the tree the next year. So that's basically it. If you see some real defects in the way the tree is growing, you know, you've got a real lopsided growth, or the branches are starting to cross and rub on each other, you might do a little corrective pruning, especially when the tree is young. But other than that, just enjoy the spring bloom and enjoy the tree.
All right, Betsy, thanks for joining us on Garden Talk today. Let's go next to Frank, who's calling in from Duluth. Frank, welcome to Garden Talk.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, John and Jason. I thought I'd call in with a comment. I'm in my 60s, and I wanted to plant some apple trees, and I live north of Duluth, so I focused on cold hardiness as my first criteria on trees, and I found a source in upstate New York, St. Lawrence Nurseries. I thought I'd pass it on. They have many varieties. They specialize in cold weather or cold climate apple trees, and they have new and old varieties. I've got some property that had been logged, and I've got logging roads and log landings, and I'm putting a number of trees in there both to get some for fruit but a lot for wildlife as well. So I've got 21 varieties that I've planted. I put them in groups where the sun is going to be available over the life of the tree, I hope, and they are all extreme cold winter tolerant. 3 years ago when the first ones went in, which, by the way, they're all whips, so they need to be cared for, watered a couple times a week, and I have them all fenced with concrete reinforcement mesh wire so I can kind of move it as need be, and I can mow around the trees as well. The first year I put them in, my neighbor planted about 16 trees along his driveway, and they were all apple trees, and they were all from local garden centers. And every one of his trees died over the winter, and the first five I put in all survived. And just this year now, last year, they showed signs of really taking off. So I thought I'd just call in and mention that there are various varieties, and depending on your needs and uses, it pays to shop around and see what you'll have.
Frank, thanks for that suggestion. I want to give Jason a chance to respond to your comments before we run out of time here.
This was a great call and great comments. The world of apples is so exciting right now because we've got new commercial varieties coming out, and then folks are rediscovering all of these older varieties, and it's just it's a trend that's happening across the food spectrum, but just realizing all the potential that we do have in our food crops and starting to explore it. The St. Lawrence does specialize in the winter hardy apples, and primarily that's because they're using the seedling rootstock, and that confers some really great winter hardiness and probably is what explained the difference between yourself and your neighbors. It's the seedling rootstock is also a good choice if you don't want to have fencing around your apple trees forever, because they'll grow up out of the deer browse line and eventually get tall enough that, you know, the deer can't reach them anymore. So, yeah, great comments, and I encourage folks to keep trying growing more and more different kinds of apple trees. The hard cider movement right now is great, too, because that's driving a lot of excitement about older apple varieties. And the thing just to keep in mind, too, is trying to gain as much information as you can about those varieties, especially disease resistance. Apple scab's a major problem and can, you know, ruin the crop. And if you don't want to deal with spraying or that kind of thing, then trying to find resistant varieties is a great way to go.
Here's a comment we got on the Internet. Ida in Hudson is planning to use a water trough as a raised bed. She'll place it on cement blocks. How many drainage holes should she make, and how should she fill it in terms of soil versus stone? And is galvanized safe, or should she use plastic?
Good question. I would think the galvanized is okay. If any concern about it, go ahead and use the plastic. I suppose either one has their the drawbacks from, you know, what's leaching out of there. The drainage holes, you know, as many as possible, quite frankly, enough to hold the, or not too many that the soil falls out, but because you don't want, and that's a real problem with these raised bed type approaches, that they can get waterlogged or they can dry out too fast, right? So you got to be able to water. In terms of the soil, putting some large kind of particle size, you know, some folks will throw pine cones at the bottom, or you can use gravel or rock, something at the bottom so that those holes don't get plugged and the water can flow out. And then really looking at a soilless potting mix of some kind. If you're just digging up garden soil and that type of thing, usually the bulk density is just way too high, and inevitably everybody underwaters these kinds of things, and so that it turns to a brick, and it's really hard to get it re-wetted and wet again. So you're looking at a soilless potting mix that you're going to get at a store or a nursery, and you're going to have much better luck that way.
All right. Well, Jason Fischbach, we are out of time for this segment of Garden Talk. I want to thank you for being here with us this next week on Garden Talk. Larry will be back, and Larry and his guests will be talking about heirloom seeds and how to find them, how to grow them. So we hope you can join us next week for Garden Talk at this time. And Larry will be back with his guest Monday. Coming up on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll be learning about women in Wisconsin history and talking to best-selling author Jacqueline Mitchard about her new novel. So lots to do when Larry comes back from vacation, talking about heirloom seeds next week on Garden Talk. And then on Monday, talking about women in Wisconsin history. This program has been produced by Jill Nadeau, who also handled on-air production. And thanks as well to Dave Potratz for his technical assistance. Jason Fischbach is a University of Wisconsin Extension agriculture agent in Ashland and Bayfield County. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of WPR. Today on Garden Talk, we're answering your questions about gardening. John Munson in for Larry Mueller this week. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I have gardening expert Jason Fischbach with me today. He's an agriculture agent and educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension in Ashland and Bayfield counties. And, of course, one of Jason's specialties is fruit trees. We've had a lot of fruit tree questions this hour, and we invite more of them. Do you have questions about planting or pruning? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also post your question and your photo on our Facebook page. It's The Larry Mueller Show. Jason, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate you being here. We've got a question from Gary in Iron River who sent this via email. Please ask Jason to discuss the pros and cons of regular size, semi-dwarf, and dwarf apple trees for the typical homeowner, and recommend what is best for use in Bayfield County.
Great question. So typically the reason we would use semi-dwarf or dwarfing rootstock is you get earlier production, and if you're getting them right from the nursery, feathered nursery stock, you'll get apples that first year that you plant. You don't want them the first year, but you'll have flowers, so, and you pinch them off and you get them the next year. The other advantage is that they tend to be easier to manage. They don't grow quite as vigorously, so you don't have to prune off as much wood. And if you do need to control pests with spraying of some kind, you don't need to use as much product, and it's easier to apply. And depending on how you feel about ladders and trees, they can be a lot easier to harvest because they're right there at picking level, and you can stand on the ground to do it. The big disadvantage, of course, is the deer. Especially the dwarfing, are never going to grow out of the deer browse line, and so you're going to have to fence them for their whole life. So for our region, if you've got a deer fence, I do recommend you look at the dwarfing and semi-dwarfing rootstock. Otherwise, if you're just trying to grow one or two trees out in the garden and not have to fence it forever, then use something on a seedling rootstock so that it can eventually get outside that deer browse line.
Mm-hmm. You know, you drive around the orchards in Bayfield, in the Bayfield area up there, you see some pretty high fences. What do the commercial growers do to fight off the deer?
Well, in Bayfield, a lot of the trees are the older on standards or semi-dwarfing, so they're outside the browse line. But a lot of them also have fencing, and so they'll use, 8-foot-tall woven wire, or they'll use electric fencing as well. And there's also some hunting that happens in commercial apple orchards to get rid of the ones that are finished on apples, if you will.
Okay. Gary's other question was he wanted to know if you could recommend a good variety for Bayfield County.
Sure. I'd recommend if you're serious about apples, try to get because again you're going to need more than one apple. So you would like to have an early, a mid, and a late season varieties. So if you don't want to worry about scab, you can use some of the scab resistant varieties. Red Free is nice, Liberty is nice, and Honeycrisp can be finicky to grow, but actually has some scab resistance. Mm-hmm. Pristine is another one. Sweet 16. And then the earlier varieties, coming out of University of Minnesota's breeding program, they taste great. There's a reason why they're being released. So Zestar, Sweet Tango, Honeycrisp was an earlier one, but now Snow Sweet and Frostbite, those would be ones to try. When we did have that horrendously cold winter a couple of years ago, we had a fair amount of apple mortality, which we typically never see. So some of those commercial varieties don't have the same hardiness that some of these older varieties grown on standard rootstock do. But typically, we don't worry about it, and hopefully we won't have a winter like that for many years.
Well, hopefully. Gary, thanks for writing in with those great questions. Let's go back to the phones, and Maureen is with us in Appleton. Maureen, you're on Garden Talk.
Hi. Which program? Back in the earlier part of the program, a man questioned, among other things, importing bumblebees. And with the great anguish that we have suffered around this world by importing non-native species, rather a person just look, there's a new book out called, a very new book, called A Field Guide to North America's Bees. It's really called The Bees in Your Backyard. It is just a fantastic book. And in it, it shows homes that you can build. You'd have to be, 6 years old could build a wonderful one in no time out of scraps, and I do mean scraps, for bumblebees, among other things. And I certainly am going to do it myself. But please, no more alien insects, animals, whatever. We just are destroying our earth with that. So other than that, I just want to throw this out. The Bees in Your Backyard, I think any gardener would just be thrilled to look at this book it has got.
Okay. Maureen, thanks for your comment. Jason, we did talk a little bit about imported bumblebees earlier, but Maureen, with some concerns about introducing a non-native species.
I think her comments are spot on. I think anything we can do as gardeners and homeowners to provide habitat for our pollinators is a great thing to do. Our agricultural industry is turning to that as well. As we have to look at our agricultural landscape to improve habitat, but as homeowners and gardeners, we can do the same thing. And mason bee nests or houses and all the rest, species of flowers that provide a nectar source year-round, so diversified plantings, these are all great things to do. And we have a history of doing this. Bluebird boxes, this was something that we still do, but we did a lot of, and now I think trying to provide habitat for pollinators is great, absolutely.
Maureen, thanks for your call on Garden Talk. We have a question from Charles in Rice Lake who wants, he's got a very old apple tree with sentimental value. He wants to know, can he take a cutting from the trees to graft on new rootstock? And if so, how does that work?
Yes, and there's a couple different ways to do it. Right now is a great time, and you would take the vertical shoots, the suckers, not from the base necessarily, but from an old pruning wound or something, that are real vegetative and are growing straight up. And that's the wood that you would use to then graft onto a rootstock. And you can just use a basic whip graft. You'll have to buy some rootstock, and then you just use a cleft graft and graft it that way. And tape it up and plant it out in the garden to baby it for a year, and then you can transplant it to its final spot. Or, and we don't do maybe as much as we should, but chip budding or chip grafting is another way, and usually you'll do that in July. And you can go online to see some tutorials on how to do it. But basically, you're just grafting a small bud from your variety that you want to propagate, and graft that bud onto your rootstock or another tree if you're trying to just do a branch graft or something. So, but if you're going to do the traditional whip grafting, now's the time to do it and get out there before those vegetative buds break.
All right, Charles, thanks for writing in with that question. Let's go to Madison next, where Tony joins us. Tony, welcome to Garden Talk. Tony, are you with us? Okay, I don't hear Tony. Let's try another call. We'll hang on to Tony for a second. Maybe we'll get him back. Let's go to Burlington and take a call from Chris. Chris, you're on Garden Talk.
Hi. So I've had apples in my backyard since I've moved here about 10 years, and I always thought they were crab apples, but I'm starting to realize that perhaps they're not. So my two questions, first of all, how do I prune them properly? And does that pruning technique then hold true for all plants that I'd like to prune? And do I need to spray them every 2 weeks?
Yeah, so great questions. So in terms of, you know, trying to identify, is it a crab apple or is it some sort of a variety? It's difficult to do, and there really aren't that many great keys available. You can look online. If you've got some neighbors, though, that typically what we'll see is that a neighborhood that has apple trees, they're all the same variety, and somebody got an idea and called their neighbors, and they all planted at the same time. So trying to ask around to see what others think might be a good way to start. And at another level, if you like the apple, who cares what variety is, right? Enjoy the apple. Now, in terms of the pruning, fruit tree pruning is, you know, going to be very different than, say, flowering shrub pruning. So it is specific to fruit trees. And what you're just trying to do is get your branches horizontal so that they'll produce fruit instead of vegetative wood. And you're just trying to make space so the wind can move through it, so the leaves dry out and you don't get disease problems, and the sun can get in at the branches. And, you know, it's hard to explain over the phone, but the rule of thumb is remove anything that grows straight up, remove anything that grows straight down, and remove anything that's crossing. The other way you kind of think of it, and one of the Bayfield growers taught me this, is think of an octopus standing on its head with its tentacles splayed out, and at the end of each tentacle is a platter. And so you think of kind of arranging or training your branches to do that very same thing. And you don't want the platters overlapping each other. They each have their own kind of space. So, but that's, you know, you can spend hours and hours learning about different pruning techniques and different training systems, but that, to me, is kind of general rule of thumb, is you're just trying to open it up. And you usually we don't prune as much as we should because we get scared as homeowners to cut too much of the wood. But if you go to commercial orchards, there's not much left of those trees after their spring pruning. They really cut them back hard. And you generally don't want to take more than a third of the wood in a season. But, you know, if you can find some other folks that have done pruning and trees look okay, you can ask them for some pointers. And really the only way to learn is to just get out there and try it and get used to doing it.
And what about spraying? How often should she spray?
Yeah, so, you know, we don't want to do calendar-based spraying where you're just out there spraying every 2 weeks. You'd like to spray based on the weather conditions and the pest pressures that you confront. And there are some decent the extension websites, either Minnesota's or Wisconsin's or Vermont, anywhere that apples are grown, they'll have some good homeowner pest management guides. And they'll walk you through, you know, here's a scab control program, or here's how you control coddling moth, or how to control plum curculio. But if you can kind of get yourself to start thinking about, okay, what are my pests, and then when are they active, and how best do I control them? And then you'll do some monitoring during the year, or scouting, and if you actually have that pest, then you would take action accordingly. Just dousing the tree with fungicide and insecticide every 2 weeks is not a good way to do it. It's expensive and it's dangerous. So,
all right,
short
Chris,
of that, that's what I can say.
All right, Chris, thanks for that. Thanks for that call. We have a Joe on Facebook has a question. He wants to know if it's too late to dock his Cortland apple tree in Ashland. How does he end consistent blossom end rot on the trees? And he says he's mowed and cleaned the area and placed eggshells around the base for calcium. So is it too late for him to dock his Cortland in Ashland?
By dock, if he means pruning, no, definitely not. It would be surprised that he's getting blossom end rot on the apples. That's pretty atypical. Usually you would see first potassium deficiency showing up in the leaves if that was the case, where you had uneven or inadequate water or even calcium. But you could pull a soil test and just see what the calcium is at. On our clay in the Ashland area, we typically have more than enough calcium, which is what a deficiency could cause the problem. It's probably some other fungal disease that's causing the like a black rot or something else that's causing the apples to mm-hmm. be infected. So once you find some infection this coming year, you could bring it into the extension office and we can help identify it.
Okay. Let's take another call. We'll go to Joya in Fitchburg next. Welcome to Garden Talk.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question which probably was partially answered. I have an apple tree, crab apple tree, mostly for decorative purpose. In my front yard, it was I planted it 4 years ago. My question is, they told me in the garden center that it was already sprayed and pre-treated. So it's been 4 years. Do I have to treat it again for the disease? And second is also, when is the best time to trim it?
Do you know the variety of the apple tree?
It's a crab apple, they say.
Crab apple. Okay. So if they treated it for a disease 4 years ago, right, it could have been some sort of a root fungus disease to help it with transplanting, or they may have put a protectant fungicide on it before they shipped it out to you. In either case, whatever they used as a fungicide would not be still doing anything now, right, 4 years later. So if you are having some disease problems, yeah, you might need to do something. Now, if crab apples, again, they'll get apple scab. They'll lose their leaves earlier in the year than normal, but it's not a problem. The tree comes back fine the next year. And really, with crab apples, we're most interested in that spring bloom and a little bit of shade during the year. So a little bit of early leaf drop at the end of the year is not a big deal. Again, with crab apples, you don't really need to or want to prune them. They have a fairly decent growth form on their own, and when the more you prune them, the more they sucker, and then that growth form just gets all crazy. So the only time you'd prune is if you have a real structural problem. It's really uneven, or you've got broken branches or that kind of thing. Otherwise,
or you have a riding lawnmower, and you have to try and get underneath them.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yep, prune it up so you can get under it. And other than that, you know, there isn't much to do with the crab apples other than enjoy them.
Thanks a lot.
You know,
go ahead.
John, just want to come back to that blossom end rot question, because it could be, I should have asked when he's seeing the problem, because it could be fire blight. So fire blight will cause blossoms. Once they emerge, they can droop and drop off the tree, and it could be interpreted as blossom end rot, but it could also be fire blight, which is not a calcium issue. That's a bacterial.
Yeah, Joe doesn't say on his Facebook post anything about that, but Joe, Jason is right in your town, so you should be able to find him easy enough. We have another Facebook comment from Mary, who writes, she has a very small area for planting tomatoes. Last year, late in the season, blight hit, and she lost most of her tomatoes. What does she need to do to the soil to plant tomatoes in the same area this year?
It's a challenging one. That disease is probably there in the soil. You know, if it's Septoria is probably what it was. And if, you know, anything can be done to get the residue from the old tomatoes out of there and then using a mulch layer. And it might be instead of using an organic mulch like wood chips or straw or something, to use a plastic mulch or a landscape fabric to put down to provide a better barrier between the soil and the leaf tissue. And then a thing that can help, if it, you know, she could put protectant fungicides on, but may not want to do that. So just a little bit earlier pruning to get those lower leaves pruned off. And typically, once that first fruit cluster is formed, you can remove all of the leaf material below that fruit cluster. And that, again, can just help dry things out underneath the plant and remove that ladder, if you will, from the soil up into the plant.
Well, then make sure when you do cut those leaves off that you get them, you get rid of them. You don't just let them fall on the ground. I think you mentioned that earlier.
Yep, for sure.
See, I was paying attention.
Yeah.
All right, let's take another call here on Garden Talk. And Paul is joining us from Watertown. Paul, welcome to Garden Talk. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys. Great show. I've got a strange one. I drive by this apple orchard. There's probably about 20 trees in it, and they're pretty tall trees, but they're all trimmed. The guy's got dead crows hanging up high in the trees, tethered by their foot. Now, I'm wondering, could that possibly be he's waiting for the spring, and when they rot, they'll bring in insects for pollinators, or why? Is there, have you ever heard of that before?
You said dead crows?
Crows, yeah, the birds.
Yeah, so this is what we call the, it doesn't really work, but the effigy approach to controlling predation from crows. So crows are notorious, and they'll fly into the orchards, and they'll sit there at the top of the trees and peck on the apples. You know, they don't eat the whole apple. They'll just take a couple of bites out of all the apples. And it drives growers crazy. So one method is to shoot the crow and hang the dead crow out in the orchard, right? So it's sort of a method that some says works, or some say works, but it really doesn't work. There's no good evidence that it does, but that's my guess is what's happening. Or he just lost it, the orchard owner, and said, forget it, I'm shooting all the crows and hanging them in the trees. Who knows what happens, but that's why they're out there.
Okay, Paul, thanks for the call. Joe in Oxford would like to know when to prune oak trees to avoid oak wilt. Also, is it advisable to put paint or tar on pruned ends?
Yeah, so the oak trees, you know, you can prune them in the winter would be the best time. And usually oak trees don't need a lot of pruning. They have a fairly compact growth form anyway. But if you do need to, you do it in the winter. And then definitely do not treat the cut ends with tar or some other pruning compound. What you want is that pruning wound to dry out and then eventually callus over by putting pruning paint or tar over the cut ends, you just trap in moisture.
All right. Thanks for that. And final call, I think, of the day. Jody is with us in Rhinelander. Jody, hello.
Hi there. I'm calling because I have an emotional attachment to this apple tree, but it got hit by frost, and then it got hit by deer, and then last year I got lots of apples. Then the wind came and snapped the tree in half. Can I save this tree?
And you've got less than a minute, Jason.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, apple trees are amazingly resilient to all kinds of damage, so they're going to sprout new wood from damage points or from lower down on the trunk. And you can just try to prune out whatever dead wood and then train the new sprouts to take over. And these trees can last hundreds of years, really, by doing that. Eventually that crown will, or the trunk will rot and fall over, but that's really all you can do. Otherwise, if you want to, like we talked about earlier in the show, pull some scion wood off there and graft it onto some new rootstock so you've still got that variety if you like it. But other than that, just do your best to prune out the dead or damaged wood and hope the tree hangs on.
And we've had several callers who expressed emotional attachments to their apple trees. What is it about the apple tree, do you think, Jason, quickly as we close?
Well, they're amazing because they put out so much great product, and you can use them so many ways, and, you know, they last forever, so they become a trusted friend out in the yard. I think that's why the attachment,
okay.
And plus those older varieties, they're not as common anymore. So,
all right. Well, we'll leave it there. Jason, thanks so much for joining me on Garden Talk this week.
Sure. Happy to
Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Agriculture Agent for Bayfield and Ashland Counties, joining me on Garden Talk today. Jill Nadeau produced this program and handled on-air production. Dave Potratz handled our technical aspects. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Larry is back next week on Garden Talk. This is the Ideas Network of WPR.